But Ashes chapter 36. So this chapter is a genealogical chapter about Esav and about Seir. Seir HaChori, who was another person who lived in the place where Esav later lived. Now, just so we can place ourselves in this book, in the structure and the order of the book, we'll remember that Sefer Bereishis is in some sense structured around, or these parts are structured around, the stories of Sefer Bereishis, lists of genealogies. We have famously the book of Divrei Yomim, the first 9 chapters of it, which is as if it's a version of Sefer Bereishis and the rest of the Torah, with only the genealogy, skipping all the stories and putting only the genealogies. In Sefer Bereishis, we have, in the entire Sefer Bereishis, there's 11 headers, or if you count differently, there's 10, or if you count differently, there's 9, but it doesn't matter. There's between 9 and 11 headers, which say, we start with Ele Toldos. These are the children, these are the descendants of something. And many people have thought that this is like the structure, the skeleton of the book. You can organize the whole book around this. I think this is a little bit more questionable than these people think, because it's often hard to see how these headers would be headers both for the genealogies and for the stories. But maybe we could somehow read it backwards the other way and say that the place where these genealogies are placed are important. They give a certain linear chronological order to the whole book. And they always give us important links of information. That's really what genealogies do. The genealogies have a bunch of different purposes, but one of the things they do, at least, is link us at different parts of time, different parts of story. It links us, like, for example, the genealogies that we have in Bereishis Noach, the 10 generations to Adam and Noach, the 10 generations to Noach and Avram. Their goal, their point is to link, to bring us all the way from Adam all the way down to Noach, and the same from Noach to Avram. It's just like filling in the blanks of that part of the story. We don't have a lot to talk about those people, besides for like 2-3 side notes about them, but it links us up. Now, in a similar way, and we already had this earlier by Avram, we didn't yet read this in this series of Shirim, but it was the Toldos of Ishmael, the Toldos of Keturah. So, in other words, it's very clear from the stories, right? We don't need to make a conspiracy, like a theory that maybe isn't explicit in this text. Many people say Bereishis is a text which describes the choosing, the Bechira, the choice of these specific people, which we have later explicitly in Sefer Devarim, Bechor Bechor Hashem. It doesn't say that in Sefer Bereishis in the words, but what we can read is that there is people who there's stories about, and the text goes on at length about exactly what happened with them. And then there's gaps in the story, and these gaps are filled in by the places where we only have lists. There's also lists and genealogies for people who have stories about them. But then, for the sort of blank space, and in order for the story to be complete, there's all these filling ins, and therefore the simplest understanding of all these genealogies and ancient question why they're all here, what they're all doing, especially these genealogies of the sort of brother nations, right? One of the things that these genealogies do is establishes that all the nations around Israel, so people describing himself to the Ishmael, to Bnei Keturah, to in general the 70 nations who are descended from Noach, all of this is become part of one family, right? They become part of one family tree, and especially these people here, the descendants of Esav and Ishmael, which are said to be descendants of Avram and then from Yitzchak. This is an important goal of these stories. But in a more general sense, we could see clearly that these are lists or genealogies that are filling in what the narrative leaves unsaid. In other words, for example, we have some stories about Esav, and now probably if you'll read later in Tanakh, and there's a question exactly to what this is referring to, but this is obviously something that has repercussions later. You'll read stories of these people called Esav, called Seir. They're important because they have a role to play later in the narrative, in the story. And you'll ask, okay, but where did these people come from? I know where I came from. I'm Shevet Reuven, who came from Yaakov, who came from Yitzhak, and so on. But where did this Shevet Anna from Esav come from, or something like that? And this answers you that question. So that's sort of what is going on. There's some other interpretations for why these things are here, but this is, I think, what is the obvious facts of the matter. So now, we need to review what the chapter has. And The chapter has many lists. I think 7 lists I counted on this chapter. Some of them might be repetitious, which is another question, but it's also something that happens with these kind of lists, right? When you have a narrative, there's repetitions in a narrative too, but it's easier to see that there's differences between the different versions and between the different retellings of a story. When you have a list, then there's going to be much smaller differences, but a list is just a different kind of text, a different kind of document than a narrative. So lists, since the most important thing of a list is to get the numbers, the dates, the names accurate, you might expect some repetition or some doubling of the information, like as a kind of got what it's called, like a checksum, like to make sure that it's correct and things like that. So what we have is, first we have a general, we could say something like this. What we have is, number one, a general story. Well, I divided the chapter this way, so I'll follow my three-part division of the chapter, most importantly. The first part, we have a genealogy, a family genealogy of Esav. In other words, what this does is it gives us the children of Esav, and then their children. So this gives you a certain hierarchy, right? There's the main children and then their children. And as part of that, it also gives us the place where they lived. So similar to what we have in the genealogies of, in some sense, we saw about Lot and Avram also, and about Keturah also, about Ishmael also, about the Bnei Noach also. Always these genealogies also do geography. They also sort of divide the people between different places. And this is something that we have here. It talks about how Esav sort of left the land of Israel, though it's his inheritance. It seems like he should be inheriting it together with Yaakov. Of course, the whole story with the stealing the Bechayra that we had before is connected to this story, but we'll get to that when we finish those chapters. In any case, but here we have a very short version in the genealogical style. There's even a contradiction in the story here. The genealogical note, the note that we have in this like genealogy about why Esav left Canaan. Here it says he just left because, for in a very similar way that it says about Lot, that they had too much possessions, too much animals, really, it means, in order to live together. So he went somewhere else. It doesn't say exactly where. It says that he ended up in this place called Zer. In any case, this is because the goal of this kind of chapter is just to give us these like lists of names and dates and locations and who was the son of who, and not much more. So that first part, that's the first part, which has, number one, the list of Esav's wives and his three wives and their respective children. It has the story of Esav leaving Canaan and going to, it says, V'yelech al Eretz, V'pnei Yaakov Ochev, he went to a land. Doesn't say where. Some people propose that maybe there's a word missing, but it might just mean to say that he didn't necessarily know where to go. Like Avram told Lot, you go to the right, to the left. The main point was to split up. He ended up in Seir. The third part of this first part of the chapter has a list of the children of their children, right? The children of Esav's children. So Eliphaz, others, and some details also about exactly who are their wives. But in any case, we have the list of Esav's grandchildren, so to speak. And then the fourth part here is we have a list called Alufim, the list of leaders. Aluf is like a leader. I think literally means a leader of thousands. So like, and this is this leadership, and like most leadership that we read there in Tanakh is military leadership. So a leader here, which is called Aluf, means something like someone who is in charge, who is commander of a thousand soldiers. Or, well, it's literally 1,000 or not. I don't know if the unit has to have like exactly 1,000 people, but it's called that way. And these are the people who commanded Esav. And obviously, if we see that they ended up in a place which is called Seir, which belonged, then was called Edom. And also, there's like this note, Esav hu Edom, which means that Esav, and we already had it for this. Also, we had an explanation in the narrative why Esav is called Edom. But here, it's just like a very short note, so you should connect the two names. But of course, they took a place from someone who was living there before, or either by force or by some kind of diplomacy, just like we had with Avram. And again, these stories are left unsaid in most of these stories, how exactly these conquests or diplomatic relationships got established. But if they're called Alufim, these are the leaders, these are the commanders of Esav, and specifically of the three tribes of Esav, so to speak. The Eliphaz people and the Reuel people and the Halivoma people, which are respectively of three of the children, or maybe the main children of Esav's three different wives. These each have their own Alufim, their own leaders, and these are the same names, of course. In the last piece, the third part that I just mentioned, had these the exact names. This is why this part is somewhat repetitious, because just a list of names and then calling them alufim. But this is important information to give us their jobs, the role that these people played, and it means that they did something with it. It's not just like, okay, these were the people. And apparently, whoever wrote this, or in the time that it was first written, published, however you want to call it, people still remembered who these people were. Maybe they had even descendants. This is it. There's questions exactly when these people lived, but not because people must have known who they were in some sense. So there's some meaning to this. Okay, so that's the first part of the chapter. Now we have another part, which seemingly is like in some sense the most unconnected part, because unlike the story of Toldis Esther, Toldis Ishmael, and so on, which are filling gaps in the narrative, we know from the narrative who these people are. Here we have people who we don't really know from the narrative very well who they are. We know one little thing, it's actually very interesting, and Hazal already said that this might be the whole reason why it's here. There's one little thing, there's a connection by marriage. So there's a woman called Timna, who is the daughter of the sister of Leutan, who was one of the leaders, one of the children of Seir HaChori, who were the people who lived in this place called Seir before Esav. He had a daughter, Timna, and then in the previous chapter we learned that Timna was a filegesh for Eliphaz, the daughter of Esav, and her son was Amalek, about which we'll hear a lot in the future. So this shows us something, that this tribe of Seir had some, that's what we said, we don't have much information of how the diplomatic relations here happened, but obviously they still exist, so they weren't entirely wiped out, which is interesting, right? Unlike what the children of Yaakov later did. I mean, of course, Yaakov and himself, they didn't always do that, and there's stories about this later. But later in the book of Yeshua, we have the story of them killing everyone else, and here there's a story of somewhat intermarrying with the local people. It might be actually meant as saying, don't do this, because it was known that some bad results resulted from that. There's people that have such a theory. And it's possible a lot, if we assume Edom, the children of Esav, were neighbors of ancient Israel, and people knew what their challenges were and what their successes were and so on. And it's very possible that a lot of these stories are explaining, don't be like them, or don't make the mistakes they make. In any case, this is the most clearest way in which we have a connection between this list of the children of Seir HaChori and the children of Esav. But we have a very similar structure, the same double structure that we discussed. So the first two parts we don't have. In other words, we don't have like a specific list of, I mean, in some sense we do. You could call it three parts. So we have these three parts, because there's three Elas here actually. We had the three parts first, giving like head, like analogous to what we have, the Shvatim, and then the families of the Shvatim, which we have in every time there's a list of Shvatim. So the three, the children of Seir HaChori, there's only had 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 children, and each of these children's children, that's the second list. And the third list is similar, the same list almost, or not here, it's not entirely the same list because not all of them are in the list, but which ones of them had the title Aluf? That's the three parts similar that we have in the three parts of the Edom or Esav's genealogy. What the fourth part that we had there, which is the story of how Esav got to Seir, is missing. So in other words, we don't have a story of how these people got to Seir. These people are in this story like the indigenous people of Seir, and the story is the opposite of how Esav got to them, but this part is not part of the story. So that's what we have. We have the children of Seir. We had, and it calls them Alif Achori already in the beginning, interestingly, but which are the same list. So that list is literally doubled in the end of this part. And then we have the children, their children. There's also one other note about a story about someone, Anna, who found Yemen Bamidbar. Seems like someone who discovered some kind of wild animal who was then used or domesticated in some sense. So someone, again, that was famous, like we had these notes like about Nimrod and others and like genealogical lists where there's like, this is the one, if you've heard of Anu, he was that Anu. There might have been probably other Anas in history, but this was that one. So that's the list of Seir HaChori. Then the third part of the chapter, and this part has received, interestingly, the most treatment, specifically in Kabbalah, or who were bothered, and We know this from other sources also in the Ma'ariv Nevi'im, and then who are bothered by what this chapter is doing. It seems to be unnecessary information, and they built a lot of important theologies, or at least maybe it was a remes, or not clear, so, allegorical readings of this chapter. In any case, the third part of the chapter is a list of two lists. One list is the kings of Edom. So, interesting, right? We heard a second before there's something called Esav and there's something called Edom. And apparently Esav is like the name of the ancestor, right? Esav, like we're Yaakov. And then they had a kingdom and their kingdom was called Edom. Very clearly when Esav avi Edom, like we could say something like Yaakov avi Yisrael. The kingdom was called Israel and Yaakov is their, you know, ancient ancestor. In the same way, we have Esav and Edom. You could understand it this way. And of course, there's also a story of Esav getting the name Edom himself, just like there's a story of Yaakov getting the name Yisrael himself, and so on. But here, we don't have that in this chapter. And now what we have here, is, and this also possibly, people read it as a kind of warning for Israel. So what we have is, and here there's like almost a clear connection. So again, we have these like lists that connect the narrative. They glue the parts of the narrative that are disconnected together. And which part of this narrative is referring to is a historical problem. But in any case, we have a title of this list, which is the list, a list of eight successive kings of Edom. And these were kings. So king is different from Aluf, right? Aluf is something like a chief, a unit of an army. And a king is someone who leads many of these things. That's the basic difference. It's like a more central authority, a king. And these kings are said to have reigned before there was a king for the children of Israel. So now, of course, everyone who read the Book of Shmuel knows that the first king, the first official king of Israel was King Shaul, and there was an explicit discussion with Shmuel, should we have a king like our neighbors who all have, and obviously Edom is one of their important neighbors who is continually discussed. So it's very possible that these are literally the kings who the Bnei Israel, children of Israel, have emulated and they're asking for a king. There's only a slight problem that based on the assumption that Moshe was the one that wrote the Torah and this is all before him. So we have to figure out how to answer that problem. But that's, I think, still the most simple pshat. Now, we have this list of eight kings. Each of them has a name of his father. So where who he was and the name of his city. And what this shows us is also two things we can get from this list. I'm not going to read you the list. But we get two things from this list. One is that these people were not a monarchy, right? So obviously if each have a name of their father, it's not the father is not the previous king just, then they're separate people. And they also didn't have a central, a capital city, so to speak. So because they're each reigning in their city. And the best analogy for this is actually the story of Sefer Shoftim, which is exactly what precedes the establishment of a true kingdom in Israel, in other words, of the monarchy, where we have civil culture of them, each of them reign in their own city. There's not like one central administrative center, and none of whom are children of the previous one. It's just like some kind of random election where the like leaders or the elders of the tribes get together and they make a king each time. And it's very possible that what this pasuk is meant to tell us is that this is a bad model. There's something wrong with this. It's not very stable. Keeps on saying they keep on dying. Again, one of them has a note by Adad that he's the one who was Makkah, who was conquered, really, or won a battle with Midian in some place they may have. Again, something that we don't really have the reference, what it's referencing about. In any case, one of them has his wife's name for some reason, the last one. And maybe that what that means is, again, then you could interpret this as meaning that the last one finally established a monarchy. And we know in the stories of the Davidic dynasty, and especially in Sefer Melachim and in Sefer Devarei Yomim, there's an important emphasis on the wives of the kings, in other words, of the mothers of the kings. Because if you have a monarchy and the big source of the king's authority, of the king's legitimacy of his rule, is that he's the son of the previous king, then his mother becomes important also. He's a legitimate son of the previous king, married of his mother, and possibly the last king here who is said to have a wife, and it gives the affirmation for his wife, is something to say, okay, now there was a proper monarchy where there's a king also has a wife. In other words, his wife is relevant to the kingdom because her children, their children will be the next kings and so on. So that is the first list we have here. And then we have a second list, which is Alufa Esav. So this is not the same list. It's a list of Alufa Esav is actually a literal repetition of, or there's maybe some differences, I didn't check, but the same repetition of a list that we had in the first part of the chapter, which is Alufa Esav, separated differently. It's over there, they were separated by their three main tribes, as we discussed. Here, they're just a long list. So I don't know why this list is doubled here, but that's the list to complete the list of the leaders of ASF.
Okay.
And maybe this is again, maybe this is to complete the history, something like there was a period of Alufim, then there was a period of Melochim, and still not proper monarchy, and just like the Bnei Yisrael didn't have a proper monarchy, and then there's Melech Levnei Yisrael, which, again, this is not part of the current narrative, right? The next chapter goes right back to Yaakov and to give the stories of Yosef, and starts the great Yosef story, cycle of stories, however you want to call it. But this is, and so this is another important thing to note, is this story of this list of genealogy of Yosef is in some way a separation. This is what separates the stories of Yaakov from the stories which I, in my separation of the Chumash, called Toldes Yaakov, and that's what the next header is. In other words, the children of Yaakov's children, which is mostly the story of Yosef and of Yehuda a little bit. This is like a placeholder, like there's like an empty page, like a less important page is put in between, and similar to how Yishmael is put at the end of the stories of Avram to mark off the end of that and then the beginning of the stories of Yitzchak, similar to how the other genealogies can also be read in a similar way, function in the whole book.